Life.
My table.
Dignity.
Security.
Free.
Jump.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Movement.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Progress.
Culture.
Human rights.
Cartagena.
Solidarity.
Responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings with my special guest, Misty Longman. Misty is the manager of the Aboriginal Student Center at the University of Regina, and we're going to talk about how the Aboriginal Student Center came about, what it does, and what the future holds. Welcome, Misty.
Well, thank you for having me, Jim.
Well, I was looking and in our archives, and it looks like the last time you were on the program, or the only other time you were on the program, was November of 2012, so we're overdue for a return visit.
I think so, yeah. We almost had a two-year anniversary.
Yeah. I think it was actually November 10th.
Oh, we're pretty close.
2012, yeah. So I thought, what the heck, let's start from kind of the beginning and ask you how the center got started, why it got started, and what you're trying to do.
Well, the Aboriginal Student Center at the University of Regina started in about 2006, but that wasn't when Indigenous education at the University of Regina started. Mm-hmm. With the help of Lloyd Barber, FSIN started First Nations University of Canada, which was Saskatchewan Indian Federated College. So the reason why I bring that up is mm-hmm. because when SIFC was built, they spent a lot of time in the College West area of campus, and that's the building where the Aboriginal Student Center started. Mm-hmm. So in 2006, when they had moved out of that area and built First Nations University of Canada, mm-hmm. the University of Regina had started the plans to develop an Aboriginal Student Center for all Aboriginal students on campus. So that's where we started out. Mm-hmm. So we have currently a space in College West right now, and that's primarily for our first year Aboriginal student program. And we have a student lounge base that's in the Research Innovation Center, just one building north of us there in College West. And that's our lounge space. Our computer stations are down there. We've got a meeting room for students and staff to book. And then the staff is predominantly housed over there in that in that area of the Building and Research Innovation Center. And since 2006, we've been slowly growing, providing a variety of different services, events for faculty, staff, and community. And right now, I kind of feel like as a center on campus, we've finally started settling in terms of a team and a department, and now we're just getting ready to work together collaboratively and start laying out all the initiatives and plans that we all have collectively together for our students on campus.
So what do you basically do? Like, what's your reason for being there?
What we basically do is we offer a place of belonging, a center, a home, a place for students to come to and to do homework and to socialize and to come together as a community. We do that for non-Aboriginal and Aboriginal students on campus, but we provide an Aboriginal worldview, and it's kind of intrinsic in the programming and services that we offer on our campus. And we're there to support students. We're there to support future students, current students, and we're there to create a community for the students within the university and within the city and within our overall Aboriginal community in Saskatchewan, hopefully.
So you don't limit yourself to Aboriginal students. Any student could come in there.
Yes, absolutely.
And use your services.
And they do.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
wonderful. We have a variety of different students. We have a microwave, so everyone wants to come to our center. We have one of the few microwaves on campus.
And I have to mention, one of the things that I really appreciate that you've got there is a great popcorn maker.
Yes. And that, I always joke, that's the only reason why I took the job. Makes people uncomfortable, though.
But just backing up even a little bit more, the focus is on Aboriginal students.
Yes.
And I think one of the main problems is probably getting Aboriginal students to the point where they're going to university. Do you end up going to high schools to encourage students to keep going, kind of thing?
Or? We're really fortunate that the Aboriginal Student Center doesn't have to focus predominantly on recruitment. We have an Aboriginal recruiter on campus through the U of R, and First Nations University also has their recruiters. So we've got them predominantly in schools. When it comes to the center, we do more, we focus our recruitment on community. We spend a lot of time at SWAP, Street Workers Advocacy Project, and things like that. But yeah, that's the really interesting point is we don't have as many Aboriginal students as we should and could have at the university. So the ones that get there, it's just, you're already here, so we're going to bring you in and do everything we can, right? So we're really lucky, though. We have that Aboriginal recruiter, and she travels all over the province. She has no specific region. They sent her to northern Manitoba even at times, and she goes over to the Blood Reserves and goes over to see the Blackfoot over in Alberta, too. So she's the one who's right there entrenched in the schools. And although we do have her out there, our relationship is predominantly the transition piece. So we connect with, for example, the Aboriginal advocates for Regina Public Schools. So whenever we have public or community events, our kind of contribution to the recruitment is connecting with them and bringing students in through on campus, bringing them here, because that's the one of the most effective ways of recruiting students, is studies show, is having them on your campus. So our area and the way we play a role is bringing them here for a variety of different events.
And then once they're here as students, that if they're having difficulties, they have somebody to come and talk to.
They've got everything when I think that when students don't know where to go or don't know who to ask, we're a great first stop, and we've got really compassionate, wonderful staff who just can talk to students. We have a grandmother, we have a male elder too, so they're both there for our students. And our male elder is Noel Starblank, and he actually has a certification in grief counseling. So he can do that. And Pat Sparvier is from Kansas, and she's our grandmother, and she's just wonderful. These are great people just to sit down and talk to, and they do sharing circles with our students and things like that. But it goes beyond that. We can help them apply for low-income housing. We're doing scholarship stuff. So anything from the personal, academic, or career, we have an Aboriginal career coordinator who's with our students as well. So yeah, I really do believe that when they get there and they don't know what to do or who to ask, we find a way to support them the best that we can.
Right. You were saying something about SWAP. What sort of things do you do with them? Does it involve sort of
changing somebody's path? Or
well, that's what they're doing themselves. When we go, what we do is we go and attend their life skills course and their careers course or their career experience pathways course. So the students or the people that are involved in those courses will come out for the day and we'll sit down with them. We bring myself, the Aboriginal recruiter or the recruiter at First Nations University of Canada, and the Aboriginal career coordinator from the U of R, and the three of us will go. And it's really great because the three of us will talk from different aspects of our lives and how we it led to the university and the meaning for us and the importance of us and what it's done for us. Mm-hmm. But then we just do the recruitment piece and acknowledge that for them. When we were approached by SWAP, SWAP had said with their life skills that although maybe somebody in the course isn't necessarily going to be able to apply for university the next day, mm-hmm. it's still good for them to acknowledge that that's a pathway they can go on towards, and right. it's very possible, right? So, and they also bring in role models within campus too, Dr. Sharon Akus from mm-hmm. Saskatoon campus for First Nations University is very, very empowered, and mm-hmm. she was a street worker when she was quite young too, and now she's mm-hmm. a doctor. So they've built this relationship with our community on campus, mm-hmm. and then they'll too bring their students or their groups down to the campuses to see what we're doing on campus, to just to acknowledge to everybody mm-hmm. that this is your campus and everybody has a right to be here, mm-hmm. and everyone has a right to belong, and these are the places you do belong to when you do come.
Do you find that how much difficulty? I'm just thinking of students coming, say, from a reserve setting, which is so different from city living. Are they especially difficult to kind of encourage and keep here? I can just see them becoming so. I know of some students that they'll go at it more than once. Like they'll come here and can't do it, back to the reserve, but then they come back.
Mm-hmm.
How often does that happen?
That happens a lot too, but the one thing we do acknowledge is that although our urban First Nations students and our rural or reserve First Nations students have different struggles, mm-hmm. they're still very much facing the same issues, and they still very much need very similar supports. Mm-hmm. So we do see that, and one of our staff members is one of those, right? Mm-hmm. Jaylene Francis is our student success facilitator. She came to university for her first year. She was pregnant. She mm-hmm. had her son. She took time away. She went off and worked. She went to SIIT, and then she came back and completed a degree, right? So mm-hmm. Our staff are kind of the messages of that mm-hmm. lifestyle too. My mother is also one of the people who had done that as well when she was young, went to school, took mm-hmm. classes, had kids,
right.
went back with two children, single mother. Right. It's just insane. But we do see quite a bit of that, and that's okay. And you know what? The fact that students get to university in itself is an accomplishment. And I don't think you lose anything from coming and walking into mm-hmm. those doors on that first day and taking mm-hmm. those classes and then leaving before your time is supposed to, I guess, be mm-hmm. completed or right. graduated, because you gain so much from that. And the act of walking in there in itself, especially when you're an urban or a reserve student, would be very rewarding. I think you'd gain mm-hmm. just a lot from that. And it is difficult to leave home for any student who's mm-hmm. not from the city, right? So
yes, I remember my daughter telling me, and she didn't tell me this at the time, but in her first year, I think she told me that there were a lot of nights she was just crying, period.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And I had no idea.
I know, and they keep that to themselves, and it's so hard because you got to keep an eye on them. I remember there was one student, and I knew he was struggling, and I was stalking him in the hallways. Like I was really aggressive. I feel a little bad for him, but he just wasn't ready to come, and it was what his family had wanted from him, and he wanted to go back home. Mm-hmm. So we just had the conversation that it was okay, and he had sure. done it. He can do it again, and yeah. that door is always open.
Right.
Right? So there's lots of things, too, we need to start thinking about, and there's been discussions, too, on campus about our First Nations students or our reserve students coming in, and they don't get... A lot of them don't find out that if they're band funded until about July or August, and that our priority deadline on campus is March 15th. And so priority deadline also includes priority in the spots you want in residence. But if these guys don't even know until July or August, they're mm-hmm. kind of scrambling last minute. So we're talking now too about in residence blocking off suites for our students who've come from Reserve so that they're together, so they have people mm-hmm. who are going through the same experience as them. And an initiative that we just started in the center too, which is our program coordinator, Rachel Janzi. Mm-hmm. We're hosting a birthday celebration every month. Mm. And that's really good for our people who aren't from the city, who don't have family here too, so that it engages that conversation. Oh, it's my birthday. Well, what are you going to do with your birthday? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm not at home. I can't get home because I live way up north and it's 8 hours away. Well, you know, like we're doing this weekend, and it helps that socialization and that interaction for them. Mm-hmm. So we're acknowledging different ways to kind of nip that in the bud sooner than later for our students, as opposed to them getting too lonesome. Let's try and mm-hmm. find ways to incorporate them earlier on. Yeah. That's kind of the goal now.
And I suppose, too, you know, that the reality is that probably your average student has hurdles to get over. It's not necessarily a smooth road with no roadblocks. You've always got things that you have to overcome, classes that you want that aren't available and things like that. What do I do? And that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, university and high school are in themselves apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. I think the act of the transition is difficult for people. You're kind of going to become your own advocate in terms of your identity on campus and your education on campus. Nobody's going to keep track of you. Nobody's going to watch out if you're in class or not. Mm-hmm. If you miss your assignments and you're in English, well, the professor's going to give you an NP. If you aren't happy with your grades, well, you've got to go through appeal process and you got to leave that up. You've got to deal with your student loans applications and calling in or your band funding and all those kinds of things. So you're very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And then you really have to take a lot of accountability, which mm-hmm. It's a struggle for all students, and it's not easy. And when we go to swap too, that's my number one thing too, is you fail. Mm-hmm. I failed. And it's not a matter of not failing. It's mm-hmm. a matter of how you handle the failures sure. when you get there, right? So that's really important to acknowledge to people, because it is very scary. Mm-hmm. It's a very scary place. And we bring in students and they'll do tours and they always say our place reminds them of a shopping mall. I don't know why, but I've gotten that from a variety of different groups of right. students, and it's overwhelming.
Yeah. I suppose part of what you're doing is getting students to recognize that a failure really isn't a failure. It's just a bump in the road.
It's just part of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just got to take it. You got to own it and realize you're going to do it again mm-hmm. and just mm-hmm. find out how you're going to handle it. Right. And failure is a very hard thing to deal with. So might as well get it started now.
Right. Do you find that you're supplying similar services to non-Aboriginal students as well, or are they just there sort of socially because they like your popcorn or
I think we do provide similar services to them. We have a lot of regulars that are both Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal, and they have the counseling aspects in terms of visiting with their elders and talking with the staff and pulling someone aside to sit in their office just to let off steam or vent about something. And they all get the food. They all have the services. Our Aboriginal career coordinator still works with them if they need mm-hmm. the help. And we're still assisting them with scholarships and different things like that. So in that capacity, yes. In terms of the spiritual and cultural components, I think our Aboriginal students might get a little bit more from it mm-hmm. because it does kind of, it goes back to their identity and their community and their history and background. So, but I think too, I guess you could argue with our non-Aboriginal students, they're getting that too, right? Mm-hmm. The saying is we're all treaty people. So they're also getting quite a bit from attending our teepee raising competitions or visiting with our elders or the pipe ceremony and things like that too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What an interesting question.
And we should acknowledge, we should have done it at the beginning of the program, we're on Treaty 4 land.
Yeah, I guess so, hey?
We're all treaty people.
Yeah.
Well, do you have, I'm just wondering if you have any particular examples of, I mean, without naming names, of course, of somebody that had kind of an interesting path, came and maybe didn't make the grade right away and where they are now type of thing.
Well, can I sell my mom out?
Sure.
My mom's a great example. I don't necessarily know if she's comfortable with me sharing her story, but she's a very wonderful woman and she's done very wonderful things. She was a single mom with two daughters, me and my little sister Nikita. She decided she wasn't going to drink anymore. She decided she wasn't going to party anymore. She decided she was going to go to school, and my mom is unbelievably headstrong. So when she decided that, there was no stopping her. Mm-hmm. And she went through university. I don't think it was the easiest. I remember spending time on campus. If we didn't have sitters, I'd sleep in desks and I'd hang out in the cafeteria that is now the bookstore. Campus kind of became my second home as a child, and I think my sister would say the same thing. And after completing university in 94, so I was just about 10 years old and my mom graduated. Mm-hmm. And then we went off and she worked at band school. She became a teacher. She went through SIFC at the time and spent some time as a teacher and decided that education was important to her. And it was something that had given her quite a bit. So she went back in and she did her master's. She worked for SUNTEP, First Nations University of Canada's Indigenous Education Program, and the U of R Education Program. And she spent a significant amount of time with them, giving back to the community that did so much for her. And now, if you talk to her, my mom is the supervisor of Aboriginal education for Regina Public School.
Wow.
So she's the one who deals with all of Aboriginal education for a whole school division. And mm-hmm. it was really mm-hmm. wonderful. Unfortunately, one of her mentors in university had passed away, Helmut Lang, and he was very pivotal in education at the U of R, which is arguably an internationally renowned education program. Mm-hmm. And so there was a large gathering of these mentors and faculty members that came back to celebrate his life very recently. And we got to sit down with some of these faculty members, and one of her mentors, who he was like her school dad. He was what our center is there for now. He mm-hmm. was there, and he supported her and helped her when she needed daycare, and drove her when her car broke down, and mm-hmm. supported her when people died in her family and different things like that. And so when we went back to see him, as me and my sister are both now graduates of FNUNIV too, mm-hmm. and he kind of mm-hmm. stood there and saw us, and he was just amazed at just the role that he had played in that. Mm-hmm. And he said he had a picture of him and his wife with my mother and mm-hmm. me and my sister at her graduation.
Wow.
And he still has it up in his house, right? So, and it just goes kind of back around that I, after he had left, I thought that just about the importance he had in her life and ultimately the importance he had in my life, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. University was never a discussion in my family or my household, and U of R was never a discussion. Like, that was my home. That's where I grew up, and that's where my sister grew up, and that's where we would be eventually at some point. I didn't plan on staying, but I did. Mm-hmm. And he's all to thank for that, right? That support and that person who was there to kind of trust in you and believe in you when you didn't and kind of push you along is really, really important. Mm-hmm. So when I see those moms, those single moms, when they're in campus and they're in there, they're my mom, right? And I'm the product of that woman, mm-hmm. right? And a lot happens. It's mm-hmm. quite fascinating to see.
Do you see an increase in Aboriginal participation in university, like in the time that you've been? Like, is it increasing, I guess, is my question.
It's growing, yes.
Noticeably
growing. I think in a lot of areas of campus, things are noticeably growing. You can walk through our hallways and you can hear different languages regularly. You can see a diverse group of people just walking down a hallway on campus in itself, which I don't really think existed when I was a student. And I mm-hmm. convocated in 2008. And so that was really amazing. And just seeing the building itself of First Nations University of Canada, right? Mm-hmm. That was a big jump for us as an institution overall. And that wasn't until 2003, mm-hmm. right? So that's a fairly new building on campus and presence on campus, and the center itself and how we're slowly growing, right? We've, mm-hmm. when I started on campus and I started in the Aboriginal Student Center in 2012, there was two full-time permanent positions. And I had two term positions, and now we have all of our positions are permanent. We also have our two elders, and we have a really good opportunity to employ our student assistants. So we have students that we're employing too. So ourself as a department, we're getting reclassified. We're getting permanent positions. We've got our elders on staff that we didn't have when I started. So I think we're doing well as a center and we're growing. And then now, as an institution, we have an Indigenous lead, an mm-hmm. executive lead too, and we have an Aboriginal Advisory Circle, and they have recommendations they provide directly to the president's office, and they get to have discussions and engage the overall institution in Indigenization and what that means for us, and incorporating Aboriginal worldviews intrinsically into not only our services that we provide through the Aboriginal Student Center and other areas of campus, but also in our faculties and our curriculums as well, which I think is really great. And our Aboriginal employees are growing. You know, we taking out First Nations University of Canada, we have quite a good presence that's coming up in the other federated colleges as well as the U of R. So I think watching this place grow and seeing where I've come from growing up within it, I think that we're doing more now, and I see it happening quicker now. Mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. it didn't really exist until about very recently, I'd say in the last 10 years, but now it's kind of every day there's something else and there's more people willing to be engaged. Our strategic mm-hmm. plan is heavily focused on Aboriginal too, which I think is fantastic. And I sat in one of our strategic planning meetings. They were open for staff, and there was an associate dean, another dean, a president of a Fed college, and some faculty members and some staff, and all of their discussions of what they want to see in the upcoming strategic plan were focused on Aboriginal. And I was kind of in that meeting because I was scared that we would lose sight of that plan. So mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that that voice was still there, but mm-hmm. I didn't have to have that voice. I didn't need to go there because everybody else was speaking a very similar language. So wow. that was really refreshing. So I think it is. I think we're doing very well. I think we've got some challenges. We've got some things we need to work out, and there's a lot of politics, and we're just like any other organization, right? But I think we do need to acknowledge and be thankful that we are growing and that we have a willingness to change and do things differently as we move forward.
Well, believe it or not, that brings us to the bottom of the hour.
What?
Yes.
Wow. Are you for real?
So we're going to take a break, and I'm going to play some music by George Leach, and music lovers in Regina will recognize that name because George is an Aboriginal blues-type musician, and he's played several times in the area, and I believe he won an award this year at the Junos. Yeah.
Yeah.
2014
and he did
Junos.
NAIG, too. He was at the North American Indigenous Games.
So he's quite accomplished, and we're going to hear him after the break.
Your love.
Well, that's kind of an abrupt stop there, but that's George Leach, and he's an award-winning, new to the scene. And I think, didn't he come from BC in the first place, but I think he calls Regina home now? I'm not sure.
I think you're right. I think he's from that area, and then he headed back here very recently. Mm-hmm. And within the past year or two, he's been back in Saskatchewan area.
And he's made a terrific name for himself in blues, for sure.
I think so, too.
Yeah. I was just thinking maybe to kick off the beginning here, if we could maybe have a look at what a student, the sort of things an Aboriginal student in particular would go through, say they're in grade 12, and they've been doing reasonably well at school, and maybe they haven't even thought about going to university, maybe nobody's talked to them about it. In some families, it's expected. You're going to university, that's all there is to it, don't think of anything else, that's where you're going. But there will be other families where it's not their experience. They've had nobody in the family that's ever gone to university before. It's something they have no idea about, and they're not sure that they should even consider it. So what happens to that guy? You said there were recruiters that go out and talk to maybe grade 12, grade 11 people kind of get them thinking about it.
Yeah, well, as of very recently, we're really lucky too that we've built some pretty good connections with our overall community in terms of Aboriginal education. And Regina Public and Regina Separate are doing very well. They've got Aboriginal advocates in their high schools now, and that's their job, right? Their job is that transition piece. Scott Collegiate's got a transitions position specific for the transitioning out of high school with them. And they just started that position, and what she's doing currently is she's sitting down with every single student and finding out what their plans are, what their goals are, what they want to do when they leave university so that she can help them create a pathway for themselves. And we had one of the advocates tell us a story very recently about a very similar situation. He had a young guy who lives with his grandmother, and he is doing very well in high school, and he's kind of just gone under the radar, and it wasn't until he came, and he's a first-year advocate at this school, so this is the first year they've had an advocate at the school, because Regina Public just put out a lot of them in the schools this year. It's the first time, so he was sitting down with a student, and he asked the student, like, what are your plans, and he didn't have any plans. I said, well, why don't you consider university? And so he went to that young boy's house and talked to him and his grandmother and said, this is a possibility. Right. And his grandmother was thrilled, and I think she cried, and she didn't think about that even being an option. It never crossed their family's mind. And he was there, so he said, yes, this is a possibility, and this is how you can do it, and we can work with you to do that.
Wow.
So there's way beyond us. There's so many wonderful avenues for our students, but My thing too, and my biggest grumble is a lot of our students in the city, there's a lot of rumors and there's a lot of discussion about modification courses. And once you put an Aboriginal student, and I, in my grouchy little opinion, I think that many of our students in the cities are being racially profiled into modification courses.
I don't understand. What is a modification?
Math, like they have modified math.
Okay, like right? What we used to call brick math.
I guess so. So what they do is they put these young people in modified courses in grade 9 and 10, and that just the second they've done that, they're automatically excluded from university.
They're off that path.
They're off that path because you need to have a math to get into university, and you need certain math to get into certain programs. And so what they're doing automatically is, and I believe this is very much one of my beliefs, is that they get racially profiled. And I was one of those students. I was racially profiled in an elementary school in the city, and I was put in a modified class when I was in grade 3. And I remember sitting in my English class in grade 3. I just moved to this new school. It was in the North End, and we moved around a lot because of low-income housing. And so I got put in this school halfway through the year, and I was in my English class, and our job was to, they wrote words up on the board. So we all had a dictionary. Right. We took the word, we found it, and we wrote out the meaning. And then we had to write a sentence incorporating this word. And so I was doing that, that was English, that's what we did. And then they just kind of pulled me out of class one day, and then they put me in a separate little class. And it wasn't until, I think about a year or two ago, and I was like, hey, I was put in modified. I had no idea I was in a modified class.
So there was no discussion?
There was no discussion. They just put me into this class, and I remember being in this class and just kind of the things they were doing and things like that, and I was wondering why I was in the class, and I never remembered struggling. I didn't think I couldn't find the words in the dictionary, but I was put in this modified little English program at this school in the North End, and I was just a bit surprised by that when I figured out as an adult what had happened. And it wasn't until I started kind of delving into this whole belief of mine that our students are getting into this modified courses in high school that it kind of dawned on me that this had also happened to me as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that's what kills our students right away, because once you put them in grade 9 modified math, then they go in grade 10 modified math.
Sure.
They can't do 11 math. They
yeah.
can't do foundations, and they
sure.
can't do the math that are required. So we don't acknowledge a GED to come into university. So their only option is retake all their math,
mm-hmm.
or wait till they're 21. That's a huge barrier.
Right.
Our students yeah. aren't going to, I don't want to retake a bunch of high school classes after I've just graduated from high school.
Sure.
I don't want to wait till I'm 21. And by the time I'm 21, I'm going to be in a whole other area doing a whole other thing, right? So that's our big problem. And
so how did you overcome that yourself?
That's interesting. I left the city. I went to a reserve school when I was quite young. And right after that, I was only at that one specific school for half a year. And then we moved to the reserve, and I did my schooling out there for quite a few years before we moved back to the city.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved back to the city, we moved into the cathedral area.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that was a very community-oriented area.
Right.
And I went to a community school. And
right.
I just kind of went back into the system. And I fit and I belong. And it wasn't an issue when I came back. But, yeah, it was just that one-off school at that one-off time in my life, and it wasn't until very recently that I was like, hey, that was weird. I don't recall struggling. I don't recall getting upset or disgruntled going into my English class or taking these things or going into the dictionary or writing my alphabet in cursive. I don't remember having any of those kinds of issues personally. I don't know, maybe my mom's got a whole other background, or maybe she knew all about this, but something I've recently had figured out, and that,
mm-hmm.
that is a big issue for our city students right
sure.
now, right? So that kind of comes back to that conversation where our students have different experiences in the city versus on reserve, but they still have the similar challenges coming to university.
Is it still possible for someone to arbitrarily put a student in that modified stream?
Yeah, it happens quite a bit, I would say. I've asked teachers to kind of, in my own little investigation, because these, again, I'm just speaking on my own beliefs here,
mm-hmm.
and I've asked advocates or teachers in schools, and this is an issue, and we have what is called the Transitions Committee, and the Transitions Committee consists of members from Regina Public, Regina Catholic Separates Division, Prairie Valley School Division, which is just outside of the city here,
mm-hmm.
University of Regina, and our three federated colleges. And so their whole component, or their whole reason of existing, is transitions.
Right.
And transitions from pre-K into elementary, into middle school, into high school, into university. All of them work together collectively.
Mm-hmm.
So they've actually acknowledged that there is a math and science kind of problem taking place with First Nations Aboriginal students in education.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past year, that was their big focus. So
right.
a lot of the professional development opportunities that they provided for their students were for the staff, for the teachers in the high schools and the elementary systems, were math and stats, and kind of bringing up that discussion of how can we better support our students
mm-hmm.
in those areas, because that is a crisis right now. So
yeah.
well, I'm using the word crisis. I believe it's a crisis, and I think one or two of the teachers that I speak to about this would agree with me too. It's quite troubling that our students just kind of get put into these programs, and
yeah.
at the very least, get rid of modified. Like, why yeah. are we teaching modified courses?
This kind of sounds similar to the way some teachers would discourage girls from taking math and science. Just
yeah.
because you're a girl, and that's not
Or like the
girls,
trades yeah. classes, right? The shop class and things
yeah.
like that. Yeah. And, oh,
right.
you don't need to worry about that. That kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly. But they're really, really hindering students at a very, very young age just
mm-hmm.
by doing that, right? Get rid of modified. That shouldn't be in our system. We got to provide tutors and find different ways, right? I'm such a social
mm-hmm,
community
mm-hmm.
person that there's got to be other ways here to support our students, because when they get there too, and as a recruiter, I used to be the Aboriginal recruiter for campus, and I remember sitting down with a young guy at Scott, and he was in grade 12, and we pulled out the academic calendar and the courses that he needed, and he didn't have all the courses he needed, and he didn't have the right courses that he needed to even get into the Faculty of Arts, which is a very open-ended area, right? It's it's kind of a really good entry stream for a lot of students. And he was heartbroken, and he had to go back and take classes, or he had to wait.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't imagine that defeat. That's a very defeating thing for a young person, especially a young Aboriginal male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
it just makes me think of a granddaughter that I have that I think in when one grade she was getting 60s in her math, and it turned out that there was a bit of a conflict between her and her teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And in grade 12, I think she pulled over a 90 in calculus. So it really makes a difference, the relationship between the student and the teacher and what the teacher is expecting and what the student is expecting. And, I think you have to be really careful before you make a judgment about what's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are other things involved, too, with the math. And there are issues because we have a limited amount of math teachers, right? And a lot of teachers who don't necessarily teach math are the ones teaching math, and that's not their strength either. And they might also have the same fears of math that I also have within me, and they're supposed to be teaching students. And so, yes, I understand there are a lot of other components to it as well, but it's very troubling in itself. The importance that that holds for your educational future and how quickly it can be just detrimental to your programming when you're in grade 9.
Right.
Yeah.
So we get them out of high school and they've got the courses they need to get into university. Where does it go from there? Like how does a student, an Aboriginal student in particular, figure out what he wants to do? There's all kinds of choices.
Well, in the center, I guess because that's kind of why I was here in the first place, what we have is a first-year Aboriginal student transition program, and it's the Nitoon Chipomin Oma Student Success Program, and there was a naming ceremony with a former elder of the center, Glenn Aniquad, and he had wanted to use that word. It's a Soto word for we are here, we belong, and this is us, like our space, right? And they thought that was really important for first years to acknowledge and kind of entrench in them in what the program is. It's we build our leaders, and we acknowledge that all of our students that come to university who are on their way to university, they're already leaders in different capacities, and they have leaders in their families, and they have roles and responsibilities that they have. But when they come into this program, we build them up as academic leaders. So we kind of strengthen that foundation for them so that they're the strongest students possible, so that when they go in their second, third, fourth year, they're leaders within our university community and our overall community, and they're helping our future leaders come into place here. And so those students, what we do is we bring them into the first year, and our student success facilitator, Jaylene, I mentioned earlier, she works with them, she attends classes with them. We have a group of student tutors, their student assistants, and they tutor and review sessions with our students. We have a really good connection and partnership with our faculties that teach our courses. So these class, it's a learning community, a classroom community. So they take the same classes together and they study together and they have social components together and they have meetings and updates regularly with Jaylene on how they're doing academically.
Mm-hmm.
And they've created a plan of what they see themselves doing and what their expectations are. And Jaylene's job is to just make sure that they get there. We have everything we can provide to a student who doesn't want to fail. If someone says they want to come and that's what they're going to do, we've got everything so we can help them succeed. And we bring in our elders to work with them. We bring in the career center. The Aboriginal career coordinator comes in. He does mock interviewing with them, resume writing with them, cover letter writing. So in January, February, they're getting part-time positions for the summer that are very similar to their areas or beliefs. If they don't know what they want to do yet, which is absolutely fair, I changed my mind more than once in university, we bring in different departments to talk about what they do and their backgrounds and the things they've done in those departments and what students could see for themselves moving forward in that area of study. And so we try to do a variety of different things to build these students up, to make them the strongest students moving forward in their academic career.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our number one way. That's our number way of helping students. But the best way is just to say hello.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you got to do. Say hello to a student first. Make sure, like, if a student emails you and they say they're having trouble, don't email them back. Just say, hey, come in and see me. Let's go for coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then just start talking to them and you build that relationship with them. And then when you build the relationship, then they have kind of that sense of belonging, and then they spend more time in that center, and they start spending more time with students, and then they spend more time on campus, and then they know more about campus, and then they just kind of find their way. I think that's the point of university, is finding your own way and finding out who you want to become, mm-hmm. and that being that advocate for yourself again.
So it sounds like an awful lot of it is about relationships.
It is. It's about relationships and supporting and compassion.
It just makes me think of what I tell people. And if anybody asks, maybe I'll tell them whether I'm asked or not. I think that if you're parenting, the number one thing about parenting is to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I kind of am hearing from you, that a lot of this is being there when somebody is having difficulty. And you may not be doing much more than actually sort of holding their hand and saying, hey, you can do it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, but just knowing someone's there, yeah, and it's the judge free, right? You're not saying be there and tell them what to do. You're saying just right. be there and listen and let them be themselves
right.
and let them empower themselves. And that's the whole point, is just allowing them to kind of sort it out, because everyone finds their own way. Like I was coming into university, I was going to work on APTN, and I was going to do all these things. And then mm-hmm. my first year I switched out. I went into business. I was in casinos, and now I'm in education. I'm doing a master's in education now, which has nothing to do with business or casinos, and I'm here, right? Mm-hmm. So we mm-hmm. always find our way, and it's just a matter of how, right? And having people along the way to kind of just be there as you kind of stop your pit stops on your marathon, right? And figuring that out. And that's all you really need, I think. I think that's what my mother needed when she was a student.
Right.
Was those people along the way just to kind of pick her up and remind her why she's there and give her the water as she keeps running down that path.
Do you find that, people that have gone through the program have got their degree and they've embarked on the professional life, do you find a lot of them coming back to give back to the students?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've got a fantastic alumni community. Aboriginal, we don't have like an official alumni community as of, it's starting, they're building it right now, and First Nations is working on their alumni group, and U of R is working with us to build our Aboriginal alumni, but unofficially and off the record, they've always been there. And it's really funny. Thomas Benjo, one of my, I guess, university colleagues, we went to school together at FNU. He works for Royal Bank of Canada, but he has an office at FNU.
Ah.
Right? So he's right back there, and he's working, and he went through the Business Student Association. He did a lot of initiatives on campus. So those students are coming to him for mentorship, asking him what he did and how he did things. And he's involved in their planning of their events and getting involved in that way. I'm still there. I haven't left. I left for 2 years. I came right back. Jaylene Francis is a First Nations University alumni. So is Rachel Janzi. She's a program coordinator. And we have RAPA, the Regina Aboriginal Professional Our People's Association, knocking on our door all the time, being like, hey, what are you doing? What can we get involved with? What's going on?
Wow.
We've got this we want to do. Do you want to do this with us? And they're asking us to be involved, right? We're very lucky that we don't really have to connect with people and ask them to be involved, because they're already willing to be there for us. And even people who aren't necessarily alumni, just in our larger community, will come in and do different things. We had a wonderful partnership come in when Noel Starblaken came on board. She brought in cloth and tobacco, and she presented it to him. She asked him if he can make tobacco ties for the students. And she did that. And she's one of our community members. She's a partner for the center. She does a lot of work with us, and she's right there with our students. So I see a lot of us giving back and being a part of that too. And I guess I could keep bringing my mom back up, right? She's Aboriginal education, right? She started in it, and she's still entrenched right in there, and she's fighting and doing the things that she needs to do for Aboriginal youth in Regina. And a lot of our alumni is doing outstanding stuff. And we're really lucky because we're such a small community on campus. And because we've established that presence of our community, it's very easy for us to bring them back in just to talk about different things. So we had this leadership forum that we did last February. And I had noticed in the center, we had leadership forums and we had presentations, but they were always politicians. And we brought in Perry Bellegarde and Oved Mekerdy, and these are wonderful people, and they've done very, very pivotal things for Aboriginal policies and practices
still do.
So they're great, but I wanted people that were a little closer to home. And we had this discussion as a team, and we talked about it, and we thought it would be really great. So what we did was we sat down as a group, and we just thought about people in our community in a variety of different areas of leadership. Health, governance was one of them, even self-identity, right? We brought in one of the alumni from FNU, and she's now doing a master's, and she came in and she had a big discussion about labels and self-identity, and she's wonderful. She's a dancer. She dances fancy shawl, and she's been on campus. She's been in the Powell community. She's on a First Nations and an Indigenous women's television show, right? So we wanted our students and our future students, because high schools came as well, to see that you can be a leader and not be a politician.
Right.
You are already a leader. There's people your age who are leaders and doing different things. And it's just as simple as just kind of following your interests and your passions. And that was the message we want to send. And the really neat thing, too, is all of the people we did bring in were all from Treaty 4 area, too. So it was literally like our backyard, right, of all these people who are from our community doing wonderful things that are maybe don't necessarily get the spotlight or the news, but are doing wonderful things for our community and for them as well. Right?
I think the best part of all this, though, is that you've got all these success stories, and but it's within the Aboriginal community. You know, so they're learning about I'm sure that they're finding out things that they didn't know before.
Yeah.
You know, about the whole thing, and that's valuable, and they're seeing all these successful people who are Aboriginal, and just promoting the whole thing. I just get this feeling that there's some momentum being created here.
And, I hope so. Yeah. That's my hope.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we're just about to the end of our hour, would you believe?
Of course.
Yeah.
Chatting away.
Yeah, right. It's been great talking to you, Misty. Thank you very much
for
coming here today.
Thanks for having us. Welcome back.
And,
hopefully not 2 years later.
Yeah, I was going to say 2 years is too long, so we'll probably get you back here in a year to see how things are going.
Cool, absolutely.
So as we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with the links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."